This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne!
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. And boy, do we have an exciting episode for you today, because we are going to be bringing science closer to you than we ever have before.
Oh, wow, this sounds so cool. What problem are we solving today, Jeff?
How can you help NASA do astronomy?
How can you help NASA do astronomy? Oh, I want to know the answer to this one. Who's our guest today, Jeff?
That's right. Today, our guest is the awesome Dr. Mark Kushner, who is an astrophysicist and also the Citizen Science Officer for NASA's Science Mission Directorate.
Fantastic. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mark.
Thanks for having me.
We are so excited to have you with us because you are an astrophysicist, which I think is so amazing. So let's start there. Did you always know you wanted to be an astrophysicist?
I'm the luckiest guy. I have the best job in the world. But no, I didn't always know it. I think the first job I ever wanted to have, I wanted to be a chef.
There you go.
Okay.
And then I wanted to be a mathematician.
Wow, that's quite a leap.
But chefs get to imagine, they get to create things and imagine creating things.
Yes.
And I find that sometimes I think of my job in astrophysics as kind of like I cook up new ideas.
Oh, okay. Oh, I like that. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Say a little more. How do you mean you're cooking up ideas as an astrophysicist?
Well, there is so much we don't understand about the universe. We have a few ingredients that come to us. We have these particles of light. We have photons.
Okay.
Right.
And we have the laws of physics that we know from studying how things move on Earth. And then we have to cook up some kind of explanation that makes it all hang together and helps us predict what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I think that's probably very accurate, right? And we've talked about that on the show, about how science and engineering is, I mean, if you pardon the pun, is not an exact science, right? You kind of figure something out, see if that theory sticks, and if it works, then okay, then you move on to the next thing. And if it doesn't, you have to come up with something else. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, so we have to feed it to our colleagues who taste it and tell us whether it fits with their understanding of the universe too.
I love this description. So you didn't always know you wanted to be an astrophysicist, but then you became one. What made that shift for you?
I think a big difference for me was when I was in college and I started to get involved in doing actual research. And I tried oceanography. Mm-hmm. I tried doing some research in oceanography. I tried doing some research in tabletop physics experiments.
Okay.
Solid state physics. I just somehow fit in best with the astronomers. I'm kind of a night owl and
that helps.
Yes.
Yes.
And I like hopping from one field to another in a way. So astrophysics, when you're doing astrophysics, you get to use these ingredients, right? From all different aspects of physics. You kind of get to let your mind wander. You have a very big pantry with all kinds of things you can build on, you know, sweets and sours and pickles and
okay.
And you put all these different things together and you tend to make a great big salad kind of a creation rather than some other fields of research. They were fun, but it was kind of like, today we're making burgers. Tomorrow we're making slightly different burgers. And next day, cheeseburgers. And I got tired of burgers. I like to just kind of throw all the different parts of science. You use chemistry, right? Sometimes, right. Some days you're using quantum mechanics. Some days you're using optics. Someday you're putting all together, assembling all these different kind of physics and bits of knowledge together. So that's one thing about it.
I think that's cool. So now do you study exoplanets? Do you study the stars? What are you looking at as an astrophysicist, or is it everything?
I have focused myself on things that are going on relatively close to the sun. So I'm interested in things that happen within our own galaxy, first of all.
Okay.
And things that are somehow related to our solar system. So I'm interested in the planets of our own solar system, mm-hmm. in looking for new planets in the outskirts of our solar system.
Oh.
Okay.
And I'm looking for other objects that are near the sun, like brown dwarfs. And I'm looking for planets and disks that teach us about how the solar system formed.
Okay.
Do you know what an exoplanet is?
I think I do, but let's have you explain it, since you're an astrophysicist and I wouldn't want to describe it wrong.
So our solar system has 8 planets in it, right? And a bunch of other interesting objects.
Yes.
Yes.
There are some other stars nearby that we know have planets orbiting around them as well. We call those exoplanets.
So all right. Are they within our solar system, or you're saying these exoplanets are outside of our solar system?
You got it. They're outside our solar
system. Oh, okay. That's all right. I was going to guess that. So, hey, yay me.
And I think I would have been pretty close on my description, but you definitely said it better. So I love that you're interested in things that are close to our solar system and that potentially relate to our solar system. I think that gives us more understanding of our place in the universe. What's something super interesting that you have found out in your career so far?
At this point, the discoveries are coming in so fast that I can barely keep up. It's been a whirlwind, really. Just this last year, we discovered these new objects called extreme T subdwarfs, which are some of the oldest objects in the galaxy.
Oh wow!
Okay, but how do we know they're the oldest objects?
Good, because as time goes by. I'm talking about billions of years going on.
Yes.
Objects in the universe tend to get more full of iron. So stars are always making iron and exploding or otherwise returning their stuff into the rest of the galaxy. And then the iron that they make gets incorporated in new stars and new planets and things. So you can see if you discover a new object and it has a lot of iron in it, you figure that it was born relatively recently.
Okay.
Okay.
But if you don't see that iron, you scratch your head and go, ooh, this must have formed or collapsed way back before that iron was made. So it's old.
See, and that's something small, right? But it gives you a huge peek into the universe. Okay. So the question is, how can all of our listeners help NASA do astronomy? So tell us about some of these cool programs that you are doing to help you figure out what the universe looks like.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because the folks who discovered these extreme T subdwarfs, these very old objects, were working with us on a project called Backyard Worlds Planet 9.
Okay.
It's what we call a citizen science project.
Oh, okay.
Awesome. And
I'll ask the obvious question. What is a citizen science project?
Well, first of all, it has nothing to do with being a citizen. That's kind of a bad name for these things, really. The idea was that it would be, it's for citizens of planet Earth. And yes. Citizen of planet Earth. But really what it means is this is a science problem that we need help with, that there just aren't enough scientists at NASA to do this problem right by ourselves. And we need help from everyone else, anyone who has time to join in and look at this data with us or collect new data for us or think new thoughts with us. We have citizen scientists who are contributing by analyzing data, by writing code, writing software on their computer.
Oh, wow.
They're going outside and taking pictures. They're going in their backyards and using telescopes. They are reading papers in the professional literature. They are, some of them are even helping by making images or making artwork.
Oh, wow.
Okay. That is a broad range of things that citizen scientists can help with. If people are listening right now and they're like, wow, I can help with this stuff, and I heard something in Dr. Mark's list that I like, how do people find out about this?
science.nasa.gov/citizen science.
As simple as that. So how many of these projects are you working on right now?
At science.nasa.gov/citizen science, we have 27 active projects that you could get involved in.
Wow. So, okay, can you give us an example of like what you're looking for? So if you look at, say, your Disc Detectives or Backyard Worlds Planet 9, what are we looking at? What do we get to see?
A lot of the projects will show you some data from a NASA telescope or other NASA space mission.
Okay.
Okay.
And we'll ask you some questions about it. So like we might show you an image from a telescope and you'll see a whole bunch of stars on the image. We'll ask you to maybe squint at it and look for something interesting, something surprising.
Okay.
Other ones, we will say, hey, something's going on. Like there's an aurora going on overhead. Can you go out in your backyard and take a picture? Do you see it? What does it look like?
Oh, and then they upload the picture to your site?
And then send us the picture, upload the picture, and we'll put it together with other pictures that we got and compare it to models and help us figure out what's going on.
Oh.
So with an example like that, with the taking a photo of the aurora, I am guessing, let's say I live in Colorado. If I were to take a picture from here, I would probably also, NASA would also have me add where I am, where I took that photo, so that my image, the reason I might want to go help is my image is different from your image, Dr. Mark, or Jennifer's image.
Exactly, Jeff. The aurora covers, it spans thousands of miles. You know,
sure.
The pole. And so, you know.
And like you said, NASA scientists aren't everywhere.
We don't have, we can't cover the whole thing ourselves. So we call for help. And that's where you, Jeff, can come in and step outside and take a photo and tell us what's up. We have projects like that. We have a project to map mosquito habitats.
Okay.
Once again.
From space?
Yeah, great question. So the satellites that we have tell us about, they take pictures of the ground and they show us, you know, where there's forest, where there's water, where there's ponds, that kind of thing where mosquitoes could live. But then the satellites can't actually meet the mosquitoes. Whereas if you go out in the backyard, you can see mosquitoes laying eggs. You can see a little tiny pond in a water cup, for example, in your backyard that we can't see from outer space. And you can fill in the rest of the details to show us how the mosquitoes are migrating, for example.
Now that's cool. I mean, of course, we know that we're using, you know, we have the James Webb Space Telescope, we have a Hubble, and we're looking out. But I think some of us don't realize how much NASA actually looks in and looks at our own planet, too, as satellites, or even other organizations do the same thing. Is that what you're saying here?
Oh, it's tremendous. I mean, we think of weather information, for example, as coming from the Weather Channel. Well, the Weather Channel gets that information from NOAA.
Right.
And NOAA gets the information from a satellite that NASA built and put up.
There you go.
Right. Yeah. So we are very much about studying the Earth and trying to understand both the weather, which is like, is it raining today? And the climate, which is like, how warm is the Earth going to be over the next million years?
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So with these citizen science projects, I have to admit, I have one bit of experience having done this. Working at the Discovery Center Museum in Colorado Springs, I had a class of students join a citizen science project called AI for Mars, which I believe, Dr. Mark, was one of your programs. And the students were allowed to look at pictures that were taken by Mars rovers and circle and identify sand versus rocks versus gravel versus hard ground type of information. And I have to tell you, the kids, once they found out that as soon as they were done their timed project to go through their images, that when they clicked that they were done, NASA got their results and was going to add that to their information to help make those rovers smarter. The engagement and the excitement in my classroom just jumped by leaps and bounds. Have you found that with these other projects as well?
Oh my goodness. The level of excitement, just it lights me up working with our volunteers. We have folks who, this dazzled me. When I launched the first project I was ever involved in, which is a project called Disc Detective. Mm-hmm. When we launched Disc Detective, I uploaded so much data, I thought it would take years and years before we got anywhere near completing a corner of it. And I got a note about a month later from a citizen scientist who said, I'm done.
Oh my gosh.
What?
What else you got for me? Is that all you can throw at me?
Oh my goodness.
Holy cow. So tell us, so what is Disc Detective about? What are you looking at there?
Disc Detective is a search for new planetary systems.
Oh.
And it's a search that works in kind of a special way. So we aren't looking for the planets themselves. We're looking for the disks, because we know that our solar system was formed in this giant cloud of dust and gas, which took the shape of a disk, kind of like a Frisbee or a CD. And so we look for those disks around other stars to help us show us where the planets are forming.
So the planets would be forming in the middle of the disk is then what I'm assuming.
Yeah.
More than one?
Like the very center of the disk is the star. So it's centered on the star.
Okay. But
as you go outward, you have planets that are forming from the disk material. And in the inside, you might be forming kind of something like Mercury. And then you go farther out, maybe you're forming something like Earth. And as you go farther out, then there's great big old Jupiter. And then the edges, more Neptunes and Uranuses and things like that.
So I have to ask, have you discovered other planets through Disc Detectives? Have you discovered other?
We discovered thousands of other disks. In fact, we discovered a new kind of disk, which nobody anticipated.
Ooh, please tell us about that.
Yes.
Well, many of the discoveries from NASA Citizen Science projects are complete surprises. They're things that the scientists didn't know they were going to find. They didn't know to look for.
Okay.
The citizen scientists got creative. And just like I enjoy being a chef cooking things up,
Yes, too.
They like to play, because science is really, kind of a, science is play.
It is.
It's that simple. It's play.
We agree.
But, right? But it's play, but with awesome big toys. Like space.
Yes.
So the citizen scientists are now playing with us, with our telescopes and everything, all of the different big toys that NASA has. And they realized, hey, wait, we can find new stuff that you didn't point us towards. And they discovered in Disc Detective this new kind of disc called a Peter Pan disc.
Oh.
Cool name.
Who got to name it? I'm curious.
I think it was my grad student.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure. But it was obvious what to call it, because, you know, Peter Pan, he won't grow up.
Ah, okay.
And the Peter Pan discs won't grow up either. They somehow, the discs are like this are supposed to disappear in a mere 5 or 10 million years. But the Peter Pan discs stuck around for 40 or 50 million years.
Oh, wow.
But then... They didn't turn into a planetary system. They remained a disk.
That's the weird thing. They're supposed to have turned into a planetary system or blown away into the interstellar medium, but they didn't. They're just sitting there, and we're just wondering what's going to happen to you. Are you going to grow up? Are you going to have baby
planets?
Or are you just chilling? So that's the mystery.
So how do you know that that's been there for 40 or 50 million years? Does this go back to the iron?
Great question. So the iron doesn't help us here. The iron helps us tell like billion year timescales. We need something more, okay, more specialized to, okay, get million year timescales. And for millions of years, we look at how stars move in the galaxy.
Oh.
So when we see a clump of stars that all have about this, they're all moving in the same direction at the same speed.
Okay.
We think, ooh, maybe they're connected. And if we see a bunch of stars that are all moving in the same direction, the same speed, and they're all in a clump, we get even more excited.
Okay.
And then if we see other things in common between those stars that are all moving in the same direction, the same speed, like maybe they have the same metallicity, maybe they have other things in common, other signs of youth, special chemistry. There are a bunch of different techniques that you can,
okay,
do.
Okay.
You see other signs of youth among them, like say they have these disks, and you put two and two together and you realize that they are probably all stars that were born at about the same time.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
So then, now that you know they were all born at the same time, if you find one of them where you can measure its age somehow, then you know the age of all of them.
Right. That makes sense.
Right. And you can figure out something about, there are some stars where you can determine their age using their brightness and their color.
Okay.
So you try that trick, the brightness and color trick, for all of those stars that you know formed at the same time.
Okay.
And you put the key pieces together and they all have to fit the same model, and you find that model and bam, now you know the age.
Okay.
I like that.
So that's how we know the ages of these Peter Pan discs.
Oh.
That is very cool. It's like astronomical detective work that you're doing. So I really think Disc Detective was absolutely named appropriately.
Oh, good. That's it right there.
So because the entire world has heard about and knows about, even people that aren't astronomy nuts, the giant, expensive, uber no better awesomeness has ever been launched in the astronomy world. Everybody knows about the Webb Space Telescope. Can you describe a little bit the link between Disc Detectives and the Webb Space Telescope?
Oh, thanks. Yes. So Disc Detective and also Backyard Worlds Planet 9 are looking at data from a teeny weeny version of the James Webb Space Telescope. So it's the telescope you've never heard of called WISE.
Okay. Oh.
Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, which looked at about the same wavelengths as the James Webb Telescope. But instead of staring at one object and finding out a lot about one object, it surveyed the whole sky.
Mm-hmm. All right.
WISE saw about 2 billion different sources.
Whoa.
Wow.
That's why we needed help from citizen scientists to go through.
Yes.
That.
Yeah.
But citizen scientists at Backyard Worlds discovered some objects using WISE that are going to be followed up with James Webb.
Wow.
That's cool. That's really awesome.
That's, yes, excellent.
It's so cool. In fact, they're even co-eyes on the proposal. They're even,
which is even more cool.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
So what is the difference between WISE and James Webb? I mean, I think I know, but perhaps we should tell the listeners.
WISE has a small mirror and it scanned the whole sky, seeing, okay, 2 billion objects in all directions. James Webb has a great big mirror and it doesn't turn very fast. So you kind of poke it at one object with this great big lumbering mirror. And you wait for the light to arrive, and then you get lots and lots of light, lots of these little photons, little particles of light from one object.
Okay.
You get a lot of fine details. You can see what it's made out of, you can see what shape it is.
Right.
All kinds of information about one object instead of a bit of information about 2 billion objects.
That's fantastic. How exciting is that? My goodness. So now that the Webb Telescope has launched and is out there cooling down, we've all read those headlines, do you know when the Webb telescope may be pointed at one of these objects for this project?
Sometime in the next 6 months or so, fingers crossed.
Wow. Something like that. That's exciting.
That's,
yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think it's just so cool. I mean, I've been following it because to me, the engineering and design of the James Webb is just phenomenal, how they figured out how to do all that and then get it to unfold everything. It's just amazing. So I can't even wait to see what the images are going to look like when they come back, you know, the crystal clear, amazing ones.
Oh, I mean, you know, the mirror is the size of a basketball court.
I did not realize that's the best analogy. I mean, I've read like the dimensions, but holy cow, the size of a basketball court. Wow.
So Hubble Space Telescope. We love Hubble Space Telescope. It's the size of a school bus.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
I've seen a mock-up of that down at Kennedy Space Center, you know, a model of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So now picture a mirror the size of a basketball court. It's big.
Wow.
Wow.
It's sensitive enough that it could sense the heat from a bumblebee if the bumblebee were on the moon.
What? Oh my gosh.
I had not heard that.
I hadn't heard that either.
That is a definite wow moment. Oh my goodness. Okay, so now since you are going to be a scientist actually using data from the web, I got to ask, what do you think or expect you might see come back from Webb when it looks at one of your Peter Pan objects?
Oh, one of the Peter Pan objects. Yeah. We don't have time scheduled to look at a Peter Pan object yet.
We have
time to look at some of these brown dwarfs, these ultra cool objects that the citizen scientists have been finding.
Okay.
And yeah, I'm hoping we'll find out the connection between brown dwarfs and exoplanets.
Could you say a little more about that?
Yeah. So I didn't tell you much about brown dwarfs, but brown dwarfs are these balls of gas that kind of resemble Jupiter, but they don't orbit any star.
Huh.
Yeah, they just kind of fly around, they zip by the sun, and they're Jupiter-sized. They're
so big.
Old like Jupiter. Yeah, they're big compared to the Earth, but small compared to the sun. And we don't really know why do we have some Jupiter-like things that are around stars, and why do we have some of them that just are kind of rogue, you know?
I explain rogue planets at my museum. I love using that word. They're just rogue. They're out there.
They're just out there.
No friends. They're not circling anybody. They're just out there.
They're just freewheeling. So, you know, what is up with that? Because, you know, Jupiter is the biggest planet in the solar system. Jupiter,
right.
It shapes so much of the rest of the solar system. It's like if there were no Jupiter, there'd probably be no asteroid belt. The history of how the Earth formed, why the Earth is where it is connected to Jupiter. If it were somewhat farther out, it would probably be, you know, pushed and pulled around by Jupiter's gravity. Every time Jupiter swings around, it would smack the Earth, and that would change the Earth's orbit. We'd end up in this probably eccentric orbit where it's hot sometimes, super hot sometimes, and cold sometimes. The fact that we're in a circular orbit, it's probably related. It's connected together. You know, it's like you try to understand the Earth's history, our history, right?
And
if you're a historian and you're trying to understand our history, you might start with, I don't know, the Magna Carta, the Constitution, right? But if you're an astronomer trying to understand the Earth's history, it's going to be hard not to start with Jupiter and the sun.
Those are our earliest documents.
No, that's intriguing. I've never thought about it that way. I think that's really cool.
So do other planetary systems have these Jupiters? Did they used to have brown dwarfs in them? How does that work? You know, that's the kind of thing I'm hoping we can get at with James Webb. And James Webb will be doing this, will be studying both brown dwarfs that are flying around, which maybe used to be around a star, but then got kicked out.
Right.
And they'll also be be looking for new planets by imaging them. So they're going to take pictures of stars and look for little points of light around them that could be planets.
Wow. This is going to be so amazing to see the science happening, like, instantaneously. You know, I guess especially those of you who might have been working on the James Webb for many, many, many years, to finally see it up in space and sending back photos is going to be just unbelievable.
I started working on James Webb myself, by the way, back when I was just out of school. I just completed my degree, and I got to one wacky idea I had when I was at that stage in my career turned into a tiny, teeny, weeny little part of James Webb Space Telescope that I'm very excited about.
That's very cool. I feel like I could ask you questions because you have been involved in so many cool things. I feel like I could ask you 20 minutes of questions on each different one, but I think it's time we need to wrap up. And we ask, I'm actually so excited to ask you this because you do so much citizen science work. We ask each of our guests to bring a challenge for our listeners to the show, something that they could share with our listeners that would get them a little more involved in something that we talked about today. And I wanted to ask Dr. Mark if you had brought one of those with you.
Oh my goodness.
You all hear that sound?
Well, because I brought 27 of them with me.
Excellent.
So to be clear, though, these citizen science projects that I want y'all to have a chance to play with, they're more than just fun and games. This is our job. Mm-hmm. They are.
Yes.
When you try out one of the citizen science projects at science.nasa.gov/citizenscience, you're doing our science with us. You're collaborating with us. So don't worry if you mess up.
No pressure.
But this is very much for real. So I challenge you to do one of these projects, and I need your help doing these projects.
I'm going to actually go check this out because I think this sounds like so much fun. This has been a fabulous chat today. Thank you so much for being on Solve It for Kids, Dr. Mark.
Thank you, Dr. Mark.
Thank you for having me.
What a fun conversation, and wow, Dr. Mark is so excited about being the guy that leads these projects that gets so many of us involved in this awesome science.
I mean, I want to go to this page and check all this stuff out. I mean, I don't know about you, but I want to be a part of the Backyard Worlds Planet 9. I mean, that just sounds so cool. And then the Disc Detectives, I mean, I don't know. I might spend all my free time doing this. What about you, Jeff?
Oh, Zoe and I will definitely be jumping on this. The fact that I have already done a class at my museum with one of his projects, the AI for Mars, I know how excited kids get when they find out NASA scientists are actually going to be using their data.
Yes, exactly. Now, all of you listeners, that's your challenge that Dr. Mark left for you. You need to go to science.nasa.gov/citizenscience and take a look at that website and pick from one of the amazing things that you can do there. And then if you find something or discover a planet, be sure to go back and tag us on our social media. We are at KidSolve on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, or you can always go to the website, solveitforkids.com, and leave us a comment there.
I cannot wait to see what our listeners are going to share with us and which projects on the Citizen Science page grabbed their attention and made them want to get busy.
Me too.
So, don't listen to another episode of Solve It for Kids until you go do that. But as soon as you get your Citizen Science badge taken care of, listen to us next time on
Solve It for Kids!